Hello, I'm Tony Ryan in Adelaide, South Australia, with a series of interviews with contributors to New Male Studies, Volume 1, Issue 1, January 2012. This international journal is available online, www.newmalestudies.com. Mainstream media continues to play an important part in the lives of most of us, yet the ways men and women are portrayed on screen have changed significantly over the years. My guest today, New York-based writer Peter Alamano, has contributed an article to New Male Studies with the title The Bold, Independent Woman of Today and the Good Men and Boys in Her Life. To find out more about how these good men and boys are portrayed in today's mainstream media, I spoke via Skype in late 2011 with Peter Alamano in New York.
Well, Tony, it's a big subject, and in my article, I've chosen to focus on an extremely narrow topic within that range. I would say that the article goes into a discussion of the three phases of the women's movement, first, second, and third wave. And I think that although on its surface, the women's movement is a much more gentle, easygoing affair than it was back in the 1960s and 1970s, well, you know, the word liberation has even been dropped from it. It is, in fact, continuing to maintain its radical core. So what I've chosen to do in this article is to concentrate on mainstream media representations of men and boys. And I am choosing a very narrow segment of that, specifically ostensibly positive portrayals of men and boys in relation to the third wave feminist. Now, nowadays, feminism is rarely even referred to as such in mainstream media. The third wave feminist is referred to instead by a very predictable selection of words, sometimes used in predictable combinations. So I have proposed in my article the adoption for informal discussions of a new term, which I have constructed by using readily identifiable terminology from mainstream media. Specifically, I now call her the bold independent woman of today. That provides us with an acronym, B-I-W-O-T, the BIWOT. I argue that it is the predominant postmodern female identity. It is cherished by the society, it is indulged, and it is regarded as a magnificent breakthrough in human history.
How do we identify these women today?
Well, I have only a few minutes to describe what I see. The BIWOT doesn't necessarily conform to any specific standards of behavior. The second wave feminist, not all of them, but more than a few of them, eschewed so-called girly interests, makeup, tending to her appearance. That's out the window. A BIWOT can even bake cookies, unlike Hillary Clinton, and not have any worry that it's going to impair her reputation as a bold, independent woman. So she can be seen frequently strolling down the street, prettily dressed, pushing a stroller, and there may even be a man with her. Now, the man may be pushing the stroller for her. This leaves her hands free to chat on her cell phone with a similarly in-motion BIWOT across town about any number of subjects.
As you talk, I'm thinking of Sex in the City.
Believe it or not, I'm not that familiar with that, but I dare say, based on what I know of it, it's a film about BIWOT. It's a series about BIWOTs. So in the discussion that I have in my article, I talk about the men in relation to the BIWOTs. We certainly have had a lot of negative representations of men in mainstream media over the years. There are some authors who've done some fantastic work in this realm. Paul Nathanson and Catherine Young are two that I admire very much. Warren Farrell is another. The negative portrayals often have the man as a buffoon. He's contemptible. He ham-handles every single household task. He's hopelessly incompetent as a lover, as a husband, and as a father. Even boys get their comeuppance in mainstream media, whether as ne'er-do-wells or nincompoops. I point out in the article how in recent years, in addition to these negative portrayals, there have been some ostensibly positive portrayals, which I call the BIWOT's good male image. This is a male who is devoted to the fulfillment of female wishes and desires.
I note that word, ostensibly.
Well, the argument that I make in my article is that it's not really positive in the sense that it does not affirm a human identity. And I find it very unfortunate that we're not paying much attention to the good, in quotation marks, male identity as it's portrayed in mainstream media, because it's actually extremely inhumane and bizarre. He has many characteristics that just don't square with human nature. I feel it's incumbent upon us as a responsible society to examine these images, to question their validity, and ask ourselves to what degree they're influencing our perception of the male sex, what expectations females can have with regard to males, as well as what expectations we're placing upon boys in terms of what they're expected to do when they become adults.
Peter, could you give me some examples from mainstream media?
Well, in my article, I concentrate on several movies as well as one book, and they're simply representative samples that stand out in my mind. There are many others. One is a very popular movie from 2001, a Disney picture called The Princess Diaries. The primary Baywatt character is an artist, and the good male character in relation to her is deceased at the outset of the picture. So we hardly even notice him, hardly even think about him. But when we examine his behavior, we find that he's actually a very, very bizarre character. He is a prince. He married this American commoner. After having their first child, she divorced him. He acquiesced without question. He's been paying her magnificent child support and alimony. And she lives in an entire building to herself and her daughter in San Francisco, a city where real estate prices are traditionally sky high. And he's never complained at any time. Now he's deceased. And nobody seems terribly upset about it. So the bottom line with regard to this perfect male is that he does exactly what's expected out of him. And then when he's no longer wanted, he obligingly disappears.
A more recent movie is one on which you write, and that is Bridget Jones' Diary. Could you put that into the context of a Baywatt?
Well, actually, Bridget Jones' Diary was released theatrically in the same year as The Princess Diaries, 2001. And it's a different genre. And the Baywatt's good male in this film is actually a primary character. The structure of the movie is such, however, that we don't really pay close attention to him as much as the plot of the film. The particular Baywatt, Bridget Jones, who's portrayed in Bridget Jones' Diaries, is a special type which we adore. She is irreverent and dizzy, to use the terms that the screenwriter coined to describe the character. There was an entire magazine published for young girls for a number of years that honors this type of Baywatt, sassy. She's basically obnoxious when you get right down to it. And the genre of the film is one in which an undesirable woman makes good with a suave, sophisticated gentleman of the world. Numerous precedents exist. One, for example, is Sabrina. Another one is My Fair Lady. In these films, the woman undergoes a transformation and makes herself worthy of being the man's partner. Putting it another way, it's affirming a realistic fact about adult human relationships, and that is that they are transactional. In other words, each party is expected to bring to the table something of valuable comparable to what the other person has brought. Bridget Jones's Diary departs from this genre insofar as Bridget Jones does not change. If anything, she's worse at the end of the film, but she gets the high-status man anyway. That's very bizarre. She is, in essence, I would say, a little girl inside an adult female body. He is perfect beyond belief. And it's almost as though we have a little girl inside an adult female body who henceforth is going to be taken care of by a male nanny. Why would an ostensibly intelligent man find this desirable? Well, read my article and find out the reasons that I have thought up. They don't make sense. In my opinion, women are placing unduly exalted expectations upon men if they want to have this kind of relationship. And we're telling boys that in order to be regarded as desirable, you're going to have to become servile. You're going to have to sacrifice your identity and devote yourself to thankless servitude.
Peter, let's have a look at this time a more recent movie, and that's the movie I Love You, Man. Tell me about the man in this movie.
Well, my take on this film is that it actually challenges the good male image. The good man is someone who acquiesces to whatever the woman wants. She has actually moved in with him after having known him only for a few months. She has some problems in her background, but he's in love with her anyway and proposes marriage to her. And basically, he is under her thumb. Then a problem arises in that he meets and becomes friends with an iconoclast. The Biwa good male character is named Peter. The iconoclast is named Sidney. Sidney is uninterested in the pretensions of politically correct society. And in his friendship, which turns out to be a very loving friendship with Peter, he shows Peter the path to becoming a fuller man, truer to himself, more expressive, and not beholden to self-sacrifice on the altar of service to others. And in the end, the woman ostensibly accepts this. And I challenge the reality of this. And I even propose that if there's ever a part two, it's going to be about her filing for divorce. Now, Peter has undergone a magnificent transformation, and in my opinion, the male bonding that's depicted in this film harkens back to a time when male-male friendships were very deep and cherished and widely accepted. Typically speaking, in our postmodern world, we do not see this as it existed back in our grandfather's or great-grandfather's day for a multitude of reasons that are beyond the scope of this discussion. So I see this film as the filmmaker's wishful look at what could be between men. And I would find it absolutely fascinating if more films were created that showed male-male bonding along these lines. The creation of this film, with its incredibly beautiful depiction of this loving male-male relationship, was an inadvertent result, I'm guessing, an inadvertent result of trying to create a foil for the female, which would be very nettling. Which is that she isn't losing him to another female. She isn't losing him to another romance with a man. She's challenged by his connection with another man. And they simply stumbled upon something that is actually really quite beautiful and deserves to be affirmed. What they're going to do in the future, Tony, if I knew what was going to happen in the future, I would be setting up a shop for myself with a neon hand in the window.
Peter, in your article, you talk about the expectation of male flawlessness, and you give an example from an article called The Leap. Could you talk about that?
Certainly, Tony. Well, The Leap describes the suicide of a 17-year-old here in New York City who comes from ostensibly a very privileged background. He leapt from a window in his school because he had been caught cheating on a Latin exam. The author of the article goes into a discussion of possible explanations why this ostensibly happy teenage boy with everything to live for and probably would have graduated from the 11th grade with honors had he lived, chose this terrible, grisly option for addressing his problem. Unmentioned in his analysis is the fact that his mother is an extraordinarily cruel bywat who could not get along with men and chose to have this child in vitro. The article makes it very clear that her purpose, her fulfillment, arises out of motherhood. So her son had tarnished her dream. And the Biwat good male image never does that. Or if he does that, this means he must excuse himself from the Biwat. He must, well, buy her a building in San Francisco where she can live unencumbered by the difficulties of being in a relationship with him. This boy, in my view, did not have that option, so he excused himself from her life. So this is one reason why I feel that it's important for us to take a look at these good male images and ask ourselves, what are we telling boys about what they're supposed to be like?
So what is all this saying about the way that we're bringing up boys these days?
My personal feeling is that we're very unrealistic. I have attended a number of seminars and I have read a number of books which address the issue of boys not performing as well in school as a group compared to girls, declining college admissions. And there's a lot of hand-wringing going on about, will there be enough good men for tomorrow's women? I personally speaking find a much more compelling question to ask, which is, will tomorrow's good men, few though they may be, want to have much of anything to do with tomorrow's women, assuming that they are bywats?
Peter, having said that, you also note the paradox of declining female happiness. Again, could you comment on that?
Certainly. There are a couple of sources cited in my article which point out that the success of the women's movement over the last 15, 20 years or so, which is supposed to create happiness. In other words, women are in greater numbers graduating from college, moving into the workforce, rising in the hierarchy, making their mark on the world, yet reporting decreased happiness. So what I'm saying at that segment of the article is that as the BIWAT has evolved into prominence, women in general have experienced decreasing levels of happiness. Seems to suggest there might be something wrong for the BIWAT identity for women themselves.
So, Peter, where to from here for women and for men?
Personally speaking, I don't feel particularly optimistic about the situation. Time will tell. I would like to see men turning to other men for reassurance, for learning to be truer to themselves. I feel that there are just too many pressures from society as a whole, as well as from the BIWAT culture, to perform, and live up to impossible standards, that there is basically nowhere else to turn except to other men. And time will tell if men in large numbers and boys are willing and able to do that.
Can this be done? Many people are uneasy about deep male friendships.
That's true. And as I state in my analysis of I Love You, Man, a man is aware of this, at least in an inchoate way, because he knows that, especially with regard to women, it's likely to be punished with excoriating criticism. He's going to be pointed to as a little boy who is failing to cherish the woman in his life, and he may lose her affection, far more alarming in many respects than the potential to raise neighbors' eyebrows about questions involving sexual orientation. So with BIWATs, especially if they are the cruel type, like the mother of the boy who committed suicide, we're walking on eggshells. And if we don't have that source of affirmation and love, if it's conditional, who do we have? So it's sort of a sticky situation. We need to turn to one another, and we're punished if we do so.
I've been speaking with New York-based writer Peter Alamano about his article, The Bold, Independent Woman of Today and the Good Men and Boys in Her Life. Peter Alamano's full article is published in New Male Studies, Volume 1, Issue 1, issued in January 2012, and is available online, www.newmalestudies.com. That's newmalestudies.com. In Adelaide, South Australia, I'm Tony Ryan.